From the National Institutes of Health in Bethesda, Maryland, this is NIH Research Radio. Welcome to episode 27 of NIH Research Radio, with news about the ongoing medical research at the National Institutes of Health, the nation's medical research agency. I'm your host, Bill Schmalfeld. Coming up on this edition, Wally Akinso has a report about how the National Institute on Drug Abuse has unveiled its first consumer publication dedicated to explaining the science of addiction. Think that the soon-to-be retiring baby boomers will head into retirement as the healthiest generation of elderly people ever? A study funded by the National Institute on Aging says, maybe not. I'll sit down for a chat with Dr. Brenda Edwards from the National Cancer Institute to discuss some good news from the American Cancer Society. And Wally shares some good news about American women and heart disease. But first, some evidence that both nature and nurture may have an effect on the children of problem drinkers. That's next on NIH Research Radio. Maybe you've heard of Tai Chi, an ancient form of Chinese exercise. The National Institutes of Health is conducting a clinical research study to see if Tai Chi improves physical fitness and well-being for cancer survivors in the Washington, D.C. metro area. If that's you and you're between the ages of 18 and 60 and your last treatment was two or more years ago, call 866-999-1116 or log on to clinicaltrials.gov. The NIH is a nonprofit government agency, part of the Department of Health and Human Services. The brains of alcohol-dependent individuals are affected not only by their own heavy drinking, but also by genetic or environmental factors associated with their parents' drinking. That's the upshot of a new study by researchers at the National Institute on Alcohol Abuse and Alcoholism. Researchers found reduced brain growth among alcohol-dependent individuals with a family history of alcoholism or heavy drinking compared to those with no such family history. Dr. Daniel Hummer of the NIAAA Laboratory of Clinical and Translational Studies and senior author of the study said these findings seem to be a result of nature and nurture, since children of alcoholics are known to have a greater risk for alcohol dependence than individuals without such a family history.
What appears to be likely based on other studies of gene-environment interactions is people grow up in not such a great environment, the heritability, in other words, what we end up attributing to genes versus environment is probably much lower. So even though the published studies say 90% of your brain size is related to heredity, that's probably not true if you grow up in a not very good environment. And we think that children of alcoholics in general tend up to grow up in a less than optimal environment.
Researchers found that the intracranial volume of adult alcoholic children of alcoholic parents was about 4% smaller than the average intracranial volume of adult alcoholics without family histories of alcoholism or heavy drinking. The National Institute on Drug Abuse and HBO have joined hands in a unique way. Wally Akinso has this report.
The National Institute on Drug Abuse has unveiled its first consumer publication dedicated to explain the science of addiction. The 30-page full-color booklet, Drugs, Brains, and Behavior, The Science of Addiction, explains in layman's terms how science has revolutionized the understanding of drug addiction as a brain disease that affects behavior. Dr. Timothy Condon, NIDA's deputy director, said this new publication will help reduce the stigma attached to addictive disorders.
Well, this booklet explains the scientific research that NIDA has supported over the last 20 or 30 years, and how this research has really revolutionized our understanding of drug addiction, essentially as a brain disease that results in compulsive behavior.
The new publication was introduced during a press briefing for the upcoming HBO documentary called Addiction. Dr. Condon said the timing was fortunate.
This is very fortuitous that it's coming out around the same time as the HBO documentary that NIDA's been a part of. We think this will be a very important adjunct to information for the public, the lay audience, to help them understand the science behind the disease of addiction.
The 90-minute documentary airs Thursday, March 15th. It was produced in partnership with the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, the National Institute on Drug Abuse and Alcoholism, and NIDA, and will explore many elements of drug and alcohol addiction through the eyes of those who are addicted and the experts working to better understand and treat this disease. If you're interested in a copy of the booklet, visit www.drugabuse.gov. This is Wally Akinso at the National Institutes of Health, Bethesda, Maryland.
I'm chatting with Dr. Brenda Edwards, Associate Director of the Surveillance Research Program, Division of Cancer Control and Population Sciences at the National Cancer Institute. Thanks for joining us on NIH Research Radio today.
Thank you.
Well, been a lot of good news lately about cancer research and treatment, decline in the overall number of cancer deaths. That's a recent report from the American Cancer Society. Second straight year, right?
That's correct.
Is this because we're getting better at treating cancer, diagnosing it, or is it a combination thereof?
Many factors, because as you know, cancer is many diseases, so we really have to look at almost every type of cancer to give an answer as to what's happening. So bottom line is total number of cancers for the second straight year declined. That actually is a report from 2004.
Well, what can we as lay people do to continue this very happy trend?
Well, as I said, cancer is many diseases, so we need to look at each one. First and foremost, the leading cause of cancer deaths in both men and women is lung cancer. Tobacco use historically has been the leading risk factor that's impacted the occurrence of cancer. So for men, when we saw a peak in the mid-60s through the Surgeon General's report, we've had a long-term effort to try to get men to quit smoking as well as women. So that turned around in the early 90s, and that is lung cancer deaths in men. So with that decline, we started seeing in about 1990-91 an overall decline in the rate at which cancer was occurring. So that was actually our measure of progress. But in terms of total numbers, it's taken a while before we've seen the actual numbers come down.
Is it in some cancers we're doing better in others?
Yes. I mean, there are some cancers for which we really don't know that much about what causes them, what we could do to find them early, or even in some cases how to treat them. The top four typically are, in addition to lung, colorectal cancer, which again is the second leading cause of cancer death in men and women. And for that one, we've actually started seeing a decline in the overall rates for women even before we started reporting them routinely. For men, we saw a turnaround in the 80s. What's happening there? Many things. Diet, physical activity, the way we prepare food, early detection. A lot of screening has been going on, though its uptake is not widespread. Screening with colonoscopy, actually finding polyps, removing them. So in a sense, it's kind of prevention as well as early detection. For others like breast cancer, we probably know about half of the risk factors, but not all of them. We started to see a decline in deaths due to breast cancer for women, the leading cancer diagnosed in women. So we saw that again in the early 90s. There, it's a whole range of things. Hormone use, reproductive factors. Prostate cancer is a little more challenging. We're not fully sure what's going on there, but that's the leading cause of cancer diagnosed in men, but not necessarily in terms of dying of cancer. So it depends, and it could go on. There's some others for which we don't have a good way of finding them. Pancreatic cancer actually causes quite a number of deaths. We don't exactly know how to find it early or how to treat it. So we still have ways to go in some cancers.
Usually with a pancreatic cancer, by the time symptoms show up, it's already too late, right?
That's right. Yeah. So for cancer, we're looking at lifestyle, the risk factors. Can you modify those, change them? Smoking, diet, physical activity. For others, it's early detection. Again, for breast cancer, we've got screening that's there. Cervical cancer, we have screening also there.
Well, one area where it seems to be lagging in the good news we're talking about today is cancer deaths among African Americans. In fact, that rate has increased. What are some of the reasons for that?
It's complicated. First of all, just the rate of getting cancer has been higher for many of the cancers, many of the leading ones. Higher smoking rates for the lung cancer factors for men, not necessarily for women. Breast cancer, you're going to have to take a look at both pre- and post-menopausal. In fact, we have more white women diagnosed with breast cancer than African Americans. Once diagnosed, more advanced disease, issues of treatment, a whole range of things. In other situations, we don't really know. Prostate cancer, much more common in African American men than other men. Their death rate is substantially higher. So, again, you really do have to go back and look at each of the cancers affecting the population, but it covers a wide range of higher rates, higher risk factors, some access questions, access relating to screening, early detection, as well as treatment.
Right. That's one area I wanted to touch on in the African American population, the access issue, the barriers to getting health care. How do we overcome that?
Again, that's a challenge. Mm-hmm. One, education information. There's some information from our health surveys that would suggest that in the African-American population, they've seen a lot of their family and friends get the cancer, die of it. There's actually a concern that cancer is highly fatal, so there's sort of this fatalistic view.
If I don't go to the doctor, he won't tell me I have cancer.
Partially that, or I don't want to know because there's nothing you can do about
it.
That's actually contrary to what, for many of the cancers, are things you can do to find it early, and it is highly treatable. So it's complicated. It is the access question, but lifestyle. African Americans, on average, are much over higher obesity rates there. Also, the people that they trust with regard to delivering information. So outreach has occurred in a number of ways, including the churches, barbershops. You have to have people that are believable, and you actually have more people engaged in delivering a message that there's something you can do about it. But again, the access, insurance, cost of care, that's still an important factor.
So education is vital in reducing the rates of cancer deaths among the entire spectrum of the population.
Absolutely.
What is NCI doing to educate the public about these risks, the treatments, and ways of avoiding this disease altogether?
Well, we have an Office of Cancer Communication. They're very much engaged in the education effort. Actually, I come from a division of cancer control and population science. One of our whole areas of research is how do you intervene in the community? How do you change behavior? How do you deliver the message? How do you tailor it? How do you make it, if you will, sort of locally relevant? So we actually are engaged in a number of activities that are looking at how do you deliver that message.
Excellent. Our guest on NIH Research Radio, Dr. Brenda Edwards, Associate Director of the Surveillance Research Program, Division of Cancer Control and Population Sciences at the National Cancer Institute. Keep up the good work, and hopefully we'll have more good news next year.
I'm looking forward to it.
When we come back, Wally Akinso has some good news about American women and heart disease. That's next on NIH Research Radio. Want to know more about the important cancer research going on at the National Cancer Institute? Would you like to hear from the experts and ask questions? Then take part in NCI's toll-free teleconference series. All you need is a phone, there's no registration, and it's free. Coming up Tuesday, April 24th, from 1 till 2 p.m. Eastern, the topic will be Resources for Understanding Cancer Risk with Ms. Felicia Solomon, Public Health Advisor with the Office of Education and Special Initiatives at the NCI, and Dr. Michael Gale, Chief Senior Investigator of the NCI's Biostatistics Branch, Division of Cancer Epidemiology and Genetics. Call toll-free 800-857-6584 and enter the password RISK. For more information about the toll-free teleconference series, call the NCI Office of Liaison Activities at 301-594-3194 or visit online ola.cancer.gov. There is some good news about American women and heart disease. Wally Akinso fills in the details.
The number of American women dying from heart disease is decreasing. That's the word from the National Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute, with newly analyzed data showing the ratio of American women with heart disease who died as a result of that disease dropping from 1 in 3 to 1 in 4 from 2003 to 2004. That's nearly 17,000 American women who did not die from their heart disease, according to Dr. Ray Ellen Cavey, a senior medical officer of the NHLBI's Pediatric Cardiovascular Risk Reduction and Science Application.
We do see progress in terms of women addressing their blood pressure, improving their diets, being more active, getting rid of cigarette smoking. Those are all major risk factors that are under women's own control.
Despite the progress, challenges remain. Heart disease continues to be the leading killer of women, yet many women still do not take heart disease seriously or personally, and millions have one or more of the risk factors, which can dramatically increase their risk of developing the condition. Dr. Cavey said the NHLBI continues to try to raise awareness with the Heart Truth's Red Dress campaign.
The Red Dress campaign, where they use the symbol of the red dress as a way to engage women in the subject of women and heart disease, and they've used the idea of fashion as a way to get women to recognize the importance of heart disease as a cause of death. Every year they have a fashion show with major designers designing red clothes, and then they're worn by celebrities on the runway during Fashion Week in New York City.
Some of the notables who walked the runway in this fashion show were Angela Bassett, Danica Patrick, Felicia Rashad, Kelly Ripa, and Billie Jean King. The campaign, led by the First Lady, Laura Bush, aims to spread the word that heart disease is largely preventable. To learn more about the campaign, visit www.hearttruth.gov. This is Wally Akinso at the National Institutes of Health, Bethesda, Maryland.
Conventional wisdom tells us that each subsequent generation enters its retirement years in better physical shape than the preceding generation, right? Not so fast. There's some surprising indications in research supported by the National Institute of Aging that suggests something quite different. According to a report by the nonprofit National Bureau of Economic Research, Americans in their early to mid-50s currently report poorer health, more pain, and more trouble doing everyday physical tasks than their older peers reported when they were the same age in recent years. The data came from the Health and Retirement Study, a nationwide NIA-sponsored survey of more than 20,000 Americans over age 50 that began in 1992. The study showed that the two younger groups, age 60 to 65 and age 54 to 59, were less likely to say their health was excellent or very good in their early to mid-50s than was the older group, currently age 66 to 71. This information begs further study, according to Dr. Richard Sussman, director of NIA's Behavioral and Social Research Program.
I'm not yet sure it's a trend until I've seen other analyses and other data. I think that it's an early warning sign that I think should worry us, but I don't think it's reached the level of an established fact.
According to the survey, the youngest group reported having more pain, chronic health conditions, drinking, and psychiatric problems than people who were the same age just 12 years earlier. Compared with the oldest group, the youngest group was more likely to have reported difficulty in walking, climbing steps, getting up from a chair, kneeling or crouching, and doing other normal daily physical tasks. Could it be that the older group in the survey is just looking back at their early to mid-50s through rose-colored glasses? Or could the younger group be, well, whinier than usual? Dr. Sussman doesn't think so.
It could be that there's been what you might call semantic drift, that their health hasn't changed, but they're complaining more, or their expectations are higher. That may be part of it, but I doubt that you'd get such a big change over such a short time.
If this decline establishes a trend, it would be a reversal of the dramatic decline in disability among people 65 and older over the past two decades. Researchers will investigate whether this trend will continue, accelerate, or decelerate with the retirement of the baby boom. This will be a critically important question in planning for health, housing, and other needs for this wave of retirees who begin to turn 65 in 2011, just 4 years from now. And with that, we come to the end of this episode of NIH Research Radio. This episode marks the one-year anniversary of podcasting from the National Institutes of Health. Our website folks tell us that up to 55,000 of you have been downloading this feature each month, so I'd like to take this opportunity to thank each of you for listening. Please join us on Friday, March 23rd, when episode 28 of NIH Research Radio will be available for download. These stories are also available on the NIH Radio News Service webpage, www.nih.gov/news/radio. Our daily 60-second feature, NIH Health Matters, is heard on nearly 1,000 radio stations nationwide, as well as on XM Satellite Radio and on the HealthStar Radio Network. If you have any questions, comments, or suggestions, please feel free to contact me. The info is right there on the podcast webpage. If we use your comment, we'll send you something nice from the NIH gift shop. That email address, ws159h@nih.gov. Once again, that email address, ws159h@nih.gov. I'm your host, Bill Schmalfeld. NIH Research Radio is a presentation of the NIH Radio News Service, part of the News Media Branch, Office of Communications and Public Liaison, in the Office of the Director at the National Institutes of Health in Bethesda, Maryland, an agency of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services.